I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Okay, I am rolling.
Okay. Do you want me to say when?
Yeah, that would be great.
The first song is by a Belgian artist named Angèle, and it's called Balance ton quoi, and it's from 2018.
Brilliant.
Ils parlent tous comme des animaux, de toutes les chattes, ça parle mal. 2018, je sais pas ce qu'il faut, mais je suis plus qu'un animal.
I love her voice.
It's the best,
first of all.
Balance ton quoi.
Welcome to Ideas. I'm Nala Ayed.
So the title of the song, Balance ton quoi, is a reference to the hashtag Balance ton porc, which is denounce your pig, which is...
squeal on your pig,
yeah.
Music is intimately linked with French culture and French history. From the politically tinged pop on the streets of Paris to inspirational marches of the French resistance.
The resistance higher-ups and people throughout the resistance were really aware of the power of song to unite people. Like a national anthem, but in this case, a national anthem that sort of came from exile.
Roxane Panchassi teaches history at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, BC.
I also do research and scholarship on modern France, culture, war, cinema, literature, all of those kinds of things.
Roxane's going to play DJ today, introducing us to songs which she believes capture the political divides, cultural tensions, and romanticized notions of French history.
Yesterday was a day of glory for Paris, a day for history.
There was a time when the French were at least able to evacuate their wounded.
After dark, the demonstrators began throwing up walls of bricks.
It's going to get worse, he says. The next target could well be the Eiffel Tower.
We're calling this episode The French Evolution, the history of France in 9 songs. And we'll start with Angèle's 2018 song, Balance ton quoi.
Ils parlent tous comme des animaux, de toutes les chattes, ça parle mal. 2018, je sais pas ce qu'il faut, mais je suis plus qu'un animal. J'ai vu que le rap est à la mode et qu'il mange mieux quand il est sale. Bah faudrait peut-être casser les codes d'une fille qui l'ouvre, ce serait normal. Balance ton quoi. Même si tu parles mal des filles, je sais qu'au fond t'as compris. Balance ton quoi, un jour peut-être ça changera. Balance ton quoi. Donc laisse-moi te chanter. Palais te faire en moi je passerai pas à la radio. Parce que mes mots sont pas très beaux. Si bête pour une fille drôle, t'es pas si laide. Tes parents et ton frère, ça aide. Oh, tu parles de moi, c'est quoi ton problème? J'ai écrit rien que pour toi, le plus beau des poèmes. Laisse-moi te chanter.
I love her voice.
It's the best.
First of all. And I adore the video. It's a very cheeky video.
Yeah.
But... let's get to the heart of the song, which is that it's an anthem of sorts for the Me Too movement.
Mm-hmm.
What were the dynamics of that movement in France?
So the title of the song, Balance ton quoi, is a reference to the hashtag Balance ton porc, which is the French version of the Me Too hashtag, but it means like denounce your pig, which is
squeal Me Too.
Yeah, squeal on your pig. Yeah. So the Angèle song, very popular in Belgium, very popular in France. And it really speaks to all of those issues, you know, the way that she especially, I mean, she's really beautiful, she's young, she's really smart, but some of the lyrics refer to her being told that she's really smart for a beautiful woman,
yes.
being underestimated in various ways, being harassed in different ways, being mistreated, not being treated as an equal because she's a woman. The opening to the video, she's dressed in this kind of like early modern, so like pre-revolutionary, like aristocratic garb. And there, she plays all these different roles in the video. She plays a judge. At one point, she plays a sort of facilitator of a discussion in an anti-sexism school, yes, where there are male and female students. And yeah, there's just a lot of different characters in the video and a lot of different funny ways that she shows the way that sexual harassment affects women. But there's also references to more serious, more violent crimes and things like that, too, yeah, in the song.
We didn't see this in North America. The Me Too movement happened and there was this resounding support for it, mostly, mm-hmm, in North America. But that wasn't the case in France. Can you talk about how it unfolded at the time?
So at the time, I mean, it was pretty simultaneous in the sense that the Balance Ton Port, I think the hashtag emerged fairly quickly after it did in the U.S. context and the North American context. And then there were some famous denunciations in the cinema, in the music industry, of men who had committed various types of harassment, even assault, against younger actors or musicians. So that happened. But there was this perception on the part of some women in France, particularly women of an older generation.
Catherine Deneuve.
Catherine Deneuve was a very famous example, perhaps the most famous example, who saw this as the introduction of like American Puritanism into the French context and the disruption of French culture of seduction and romance, and that, you know, it's going to make women super apprehensive about accepting compliments, flattery, all of these things that are seen as gallantry, like chivalry, all of these things that that women enjoy from, you know, Deneuve's perspective and the others who participated in this resistance to the Me Too movement, and that it would ruin, you know, romance and seduction. That reaction was pretty intense, and it was definitely divided generationally somewhat.
They say it's puritanical and fueled by a hatred of men. This urge to send men to the slaughterhouse instead of helping women be more autonomous helps the enemies of sexual freedom, the 100 women said in a column published in Le Monde newspaper.
There was a kind of opposition between feminists who saw this as an opportunity to be critical of French cultural milieu where women are in positions of inferiority or their wages are lower, some of these other things, sexism, sexual harassment, all of these kinds of things. So the same issues, but they definitely took on a particular form in the French context, and that opposition between women who saw this as an opportunity and women who saw it as a kind of suppression of femininity or the idea that seduction plays an important role in French culture and French society, and that this emphasis on radical equality and on persecuting publicly sometimes men who had committed a range of acts, that was just the introduction of a foreign element, of a foreign morality into French relations. Yeah.
Let's go back 100 years or so. Can you set up the next song?
So the next song is a song that was recorded in the interwar years, so between the two world wars, by Josephine Baker. And it's called J'ai deux amours.
On décor des mers, là-bas sur le ciel clair, il existe une cité. Au séjour enchanté et sur les grands arbres noirs chaque soir vers elle s'en va tout mon espoir. J'ai deux amours, mon pays et Paris. Ah, ravi, ma savane est belle, mais à quoi bon nier ce qui m'ensorcelle, c'est Paris, Paris tout entier. Le voir un jour êtes jolie, les deux à vous, mon pays Paris.
There's something so nostalgic about that sound.
Mm-hmm.
Josephine Baker was just one of several Black American artists who were in Paris, who called Paris home in the 1920s. What was it about Paris that made it, that drew so many Black Americans in that period?
Paris has long been a kind of cultural center for musicians, artists, even before this period, after the First World War. But it was a place that, in particular, African-American artists, they saw in Paris and in France an opportunity to escape the type of racism that existed and the type of segregation and discrimination that they experienced in the U.S.
It's so powerful to hear the words, a community in exile, when we're listening to a song where she's calling both Paris and the U.S. her home.
Yeah, yeah, that she loves both of them equally. So she was a big part of this scene of African-American artists and musicians. I think her image drew on not only ideas, you know, she was American, but she also performed in a way that was very provocative. And she drew on all sorts of images and representations of Black women in particular. So she danced in a banana skirt. She danced in a semi-nude review. She brought in themes that drew on African culture and Caribbean culture. And so she became this kind of every Black woman for largely white French audiences, right? Yes. So she was part of this Black community, but she was entertainment for French culture and society in that way that drew on all those different racial and enforced some of those racial stereotypes about Black women especially.
And yet one could be tempted to call that sound of that song very French.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, she sounded French. She sang in French and in English. And then she became really immersed in French culture and she stayed there, you know, for the rest of her life.
Mm-hmm. It sounded like when you described the sense of opportunity for Black artists in Paris in the 20s, you wanted to add a but. What's the but?
So there were other Black people in France in the 20s and and in Paris in the 20s. And I think when we talk about and even romanticize the very lively, wonderful culture of African Americans in Paris in this period, the people that get left out of that story are all of the people throughout the French Empire and those who happen to be living in France and in Paris who had a very, very different experience of racial dynamics in France. And this community of African Americans in France has allowed the French to, this tradition kind of fleeing to Paris has allowed the French to really tout their universalism and their embrace and, you know, it's a race-blind society. But that is not the reality or the history that exists in France or existed in its empire for other Black figures.
Hello and welcome to France 24's special coverage of Josephine Baker's induction into the Pantheon here in Paris. The Missouri-born dancer, who was also a spy for the French during the World War II and a civil rights activist, will be honoured in the final resting place of France's most celebrated citizens. Among those attending the ceremony will be members of her family.
How does that kind of uncertain position that she had in France fit into the symbolism around who she is today, like the decision to symbolically inter her into the Pantheon, for example?
Bringing Josephine Baker into the Pantheon was an incredible moment in French culture and politics to talk about race in France. Of course, it was exciting to have this first Black woman brought into the Pantheon. That was an exciting moment and what that represented and to have her history and her legacy honored in this way. But it also became an opportunity for a number of people, including scholars of Black France, Black scholars, to talk about the fact that contemporary race relations in France are a real serious ongoing concern. you know, since 2020, France has had its own version of Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
And to see the way that this inclusion doesn't eliminate or it shouldn't erase the very complicated histories of race in France and the very complicated problem of racial inequality in contemporary France. We are listening to, next, a song that has been referred to as the Marseillaise of the Resistance. It was written during the Second World War, and it is called Le Chant des Partisans.
Amis, entends-tu le vol noir des corbeaux sur nos plaines? Amis, entends-tu les cris sourds du pays qu'on enchaîne? Oh, et partisans, ouvriers, paysans, c'est l'alarme.
Such a simple song. Just a drum and voices.
Mm-hmm.
But it sends chills down the back.
Totally. It was meant to be an anthem of the French Resistance.
Yeah.
The Resistance, you know, higher-ups and people throughout the French Resistance were really aware of the power of song to unite people, like a national anthem, but in this case, a national anthem that sort of came from exile and came to represent the free French. And you can hear the melody, that sound of this melody when whistled became really iconic and was, during the war, a way that people, once the song became popular throughout the resistance, it was a way that people could tell or let people know that they were also with the resistance in occupied and France. So it was, that sound is, in its simplicity, has that kind of militaristic vibe, but it also, it was very easy for it to become the most recognizable tune associated with the resistance.
So did people literally whistle to each other so they know if...
Yeah, there are stories of people, I mean, some of them may be apocryphal, but there are stories of people letting each other know, like, that the coast was clear by whistling, or just being able to recognize another resistant from the song. Like, if you knew the song and you were singing the song, like, that probably meant that you were on the right side of the war.
Oh, et partisans, ouvriers, paysans, c'est l'alarme.
You said that it came from exile. Can you just tell the story of how it came about?
Oh, yeah. So the melody was composed by this Russian woman who had left, she had been living in France, and she had fled France to London, like a number of French people had done to escape the German occupation, or just before the German occupation in 1940. And she came up with this melody, and eventually, you know, members of the Free French Forces, members of the resistance had heard the song, found lyricists to come up with words to the song that refer to the cause of the resistance and defending France. And the whole thing came together and then had to be smuggled into France, which is this crazy story. Was smuggled into France by the RAF. You know, would
the
drop
Royal Air
off.
Force.
Yeah, the Royal Air Force.
The British Royal Air Force.
That's right. And they would drop packages in France, and the lyrics, the handwritten lyrics to this song, the music to this song, was shared throughout France after being brought in that way,
wow,
in the way that other things would be smuggled in.
The idea of resistance is almost, you know, inextricably linked in our minds to France and French history.
Mm-hmm.
Where does it sit today? Like, where does that idea sit today?
That's a really good question. After the war, immediately after the war, I mean, France was divided during the war, right? There's the Vichy state was a collaborationist state, collaborating with the Germans. And the Free French and the leadership of de Gaulle was operating outside of France. And then after the war, it becomes the story about the war that France resisted, that there were these pockets of people who didn't, but that the real France is to be found in the story of the resistance, rather than confronting that the real France also included collaboration, and the real France also deported thousands of French Jews, French and foreign Jews who happened to be in France, to Nazi camps. So that's that struggle, like that coming to terms with that past and trying to figure out a way to understand that the real France was both of those things, at least, during the Second World War was a really important kind of moment of crisis. And it's not really over. I think people are still dealing with that. Yeah.
So the next song is quite special. What is it?
Yes. It is La Vie en Rose, performed by Edith Piaf.
Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche, voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est lui pour moi, moi pour lui dans la vie. Il me l'a dit, l'a juré pour la vie.
So the first thing that comes to mind for me is weddings, because I didn't know this before I lived in France. I knew the song. I knew that it was a love song. I knew all of that. But I didn't realize that it's a song that you hear at every single French wedding.
Yeah.
And that everybody knows the words to. I mean, I think people here, a lot of people here know the words to, but it's like a... Everybody can sing this song in France.
It's kind of an end of a night drunken song.
Yes.
Everybody joins in.
That's right. Yeah. Everybody can sing along.
But also, I remember hearing it just on the streets, you know, as a lone trumpeter in Paris, just in the middle of the night playing a solo, and it's this song.
Yeah.
What is the story in this song?
It's a story of what her lover says to her, you know, and that when she's with him and hears the sweet words that he whispers to her or speaks to her in low tones, you know, that she sees life, the direct translation is life in pink, but I guess we would say rose-colored glasses, like that's what love does to her. Mm. But when you know her life story and how much struggle she faced and her kind of brokenhearted various episodes of heartbreak and her drug struggle with drugs and all of these things, the song just takes on a whole other quality, I think.
Was there a specific context to the song when it was first recorded?
It was, I think, one of the things that I think is important about the song is that it's really like an end of war song. And so I hear it, I mean, I'm a French historian, so when I hear it, I hear Piaf, I hear her life story, I hear the tradition of romance that France and Paris, especially, all of those things are supposed to, capital of love, number one honeymoon destination.
Yes.
So it has all of those things. I think of all of those things, but I also think of, you know, what the end of the war means, what kind of optimism people have about the future when the Second World War ends, but then also what sort of legacies are going to be left by the war, and that there's like a melancholy that's never going to really go away, or that isn't going to go away despite the liberation. So that's what I hear when I think of the song, because of when it was written and released in that immediate post-war period.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think about this song, I also think about especially the role of women in France in this period and the role that they'll play in the recovery, but also in that immediate period of the liberation, women who had relations of different kinds with German soldiers were labeled horizontal collaborators, and many of them were pulled into the streets and shaved, had their heads shaved publicly, right? So even though this song isn't about those things, because of the moment of its release and because of that atmosphere in France, yes, it makes me think of weddings but it also makes me think of that history and that moment when people would have heard it and what they would have been experiencing and thinking about at that time.
A very difficult time.
Yeah.
This is Matthew Halton of the CBC, speaking from France. Crowds are in the streets, sometimes singing the Marseillaise, watching Frenchmen and Americans bring in truckload after truckload of German prisoners. Just now, a deep silence fell over the crowd when three French women were brought in. Other women had been booed because they had lived with the Germans. That was a shameful enough thing to the French, but these last three women were not booed. They were just stared at in a terrible silence because they had sent members of the resistance movement to torture and death. They will be tried by court-martial and probably shot, said a French doctor of the resistance. And then I said, but doctor, there's one thing I don't like. I don't like to see these women having their hair shaved off. I saw the Germans do that in 1933. And after all, in every country there are loose women who earn their living that way. That's the fault of society. The doctor replied, yes, it's degrading. These women have consorted with Germans. For the most part, even our loose women refuse to do that. This is Matthew Halton of the CBC, speaking from France.
You're listening to Ideas and an episode we're calling The French Evolution, The History of France in Nine Songs. We're a podcast and a broadcast heard on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius XM, in Australia on ABC Radio National, and around the world at cbc.ca/ideas. You can find us on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Nala Ayed.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Tens of thousands of demonstrators have taken to the streets across France in a 10th day of national protests. Demonstrators are rallying against the government's pension reform plan, which was pushed through Parliament earlier this month.
France has a long-running culture of protests, strikes, and anti-government riots.
And the CBC's Chris Brown is on this story for us. He joins me now from Paris, where some of the biggest protests have been taking place.
It's a theme that'll come up a lot in this part of our musical journey through the history of France in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Well, it's pretty noisy. Some guy just walked past me with like a ghetto blaster and blew my ears out. So there's lots and lots of noise here. Drums, people banging on pots and pans. And of course, you know, you can hear it. They're pretty happy. They're singing songs. It's not been a violent crowd.
People still repeat some of these songs. People will sing working class songs from earlier in the 20th century, using songs as a form of protest, kind of that poetry set to music.
Roxanne Penchassi is a history professor at Simon Fraser University with a focus on French culture, cinema, and music.
So we're moving on in time, and you've got the next song for us. What's that?
The next song is a song from 1954 by the poet and musician Boris Vian, and it is called Le Déserteur.
Monsieur le Président, je vous fais une lettre que vous lirez peut-être si vous avez le temps. Je viens de recevoir mes papiers militaires pour partir à la guerre avant mercredi soir. Monsieur le Président, je ne veux pas la fête, je ne suis pas sur terre pour tuer des pauvres gens. C'est pas pour vous fâcher il faut que je vous dise, ma décision est prise, je m'en vais déserter.
Le déserteur, the deserter.
It's an anti-war anthem. The first time it was performed was the day of France's defeat in Vietnam, Indochina, at Dien Bien Phu in May 1954.
There was a time when the French were at least able to evacuate their wounded. But since the communists captured the airstrip, that has become impossible. Now no planes land or take off at Dien Bien Phu.
Like a brutal colonial war. And then, of course, 1954 is also the year when the Algerian War really gets fired up. So it emerged at this moment between these, like sort of on the edge of these two colonial wars. And it is about a potential soldier's response to his conscription letter, like he's being called up.
Wow.
And he doesn't want to go.
And he's writing to the president.
Yeah. He writes a letter to the president. So it's the song is in the form of a letter about how he doesn't want to kill people. And he's decided to desert.
I mean, there is so much in French culture, music and other forms of art that address the idea of resistance.
Yeah. And in this case, it's the resistance against participating in a colonial war. So I think, and, you know, we talked about the Le Chant des Partisans, and this song in a different way was a clandestine song because it was written and then released and then performed. But when it was first performed, Villon had to change the lyrics. So it wasn't addressed to the president. It was addressed to Messieurs qu'on nomme grand, like the men of high places kind of thing. And so in those lyrics, he doesn't desert. The singer doesn't desert. He just decides that he can't, that wars are stupid and he doesn't want to participate in them. And at the end of the last stanza of the song, when it was modified, isn't that in the original version of the song, Villon's lyrics are that, you know, the police or whoever are going to come for me if I desert and I'm armed, I'm ready for them. And the last stanza of the song was changed to the exact opposite of that, like I won't be armed and so they can, you know, gun me down, basically. So that was when the song, so there are multiple versions of this song, and there's the more kind of anti-war version, and then there's more what's described as the more pacifist version. Mm-hmm. But the song was then banned from the radio during, after 1954, so during the entire period of the Algerian War, and it wasn't allowed, they couldn't play it on the radio until 1962, the end of the Algerian War. So I really connected to that period and connected to resistance against that war in particular.
Yeah.
The French didn't acknowledge officially that the Algerian War was a war until 1999. It was called the events. It was called, you know, the events to restore order in North Africa. It was referred to in these kinds of oblique ways. And it wasn't until 1999 that there was an official decision to acknowledge that there was something called an Algerian War from 1954 to 1962. So that alone, you know, shows the suppression of that story. Like, it's another one of those kinds of things where people know what happened, but public acknowledgement, public discussion of those things, and the suppression of archives, documents and the history of that, you know, it only starts to open up decades later. And I'd say that the legacies of that conflict, along with other colonial wars and struggles, combined with the fact that there is this significant population of first immigrants, but then second generation young people, older people now, in the decades after the Algerian War, means that that legacy isn't settled at all.
So that's a theme we are going to come back to in a moment. But we have another song to listen to right now. Which is that one?
So this is a song from 1968 by Jacques Dutronc, and it is called Il est 5 heures, Paris s'éveille.
Je suis le dauphin de la place Dauphine et la place Blanche à mauvaise mine. Les camions sont pleins de lait, les balayeurs sont pleins de balais. Il est 5 heures, Paris s'éveille. Paris
s'éveille. Les travestis vont se raser, les stripteaseuses sont rhabillées. Les traversins sont écrasés, les amoureux sont fatigués. Il est 5 heures, Paris s'éveille.
So it sounds like a frenetic morning in Paris.
Yeah, it is morning in Paris, and it touches on all of these different sort of landmarks and places across the city. But it became this kind of anthem for 1968 and the eruption of student and worker protests in May for several weeks. Because it's this song about Paris waking up, right? So it's a song about the morning and about different things going on in the city, but it became this kind of, it became really connected to that idea of Paris and of France waking up.
But it wasn't the intention.
No, it was just supposed to be a cool song about, you know, based on, I think the story was just, yeah, let's make a song about Paris in the morning and what the city is like and this upbeat tune about the city, yeah.
So how does that happen? How did the song become the anthem for something that was quite an upheaval?
I think it was just the moment of its release, you know, that people started to hear it and associate it with that. There were other versions of the lyrics, like none of them come to mind right now, but other versions of the lyrics that kind of upped that revolutionary protest vibe in the song. And then it became one of these songs that was adopted by protesters, and they'd sing them, you know, on the barricades and in the streets, they'd sing the song. And, you know, because the events of May, as they're called in France, erupted really just a few weeks before the song was released.
Okay. Can you just explain what the events of May were?
The context of 1968 is one in which we're like a generation out from the Second World War. A huge baby boom follows the Second World War, a lot of young people, exploding universities, the eruption of strikes and protests. It sort of begins with these student protests. And you've got this huge community, as I say, of young people, this generation that's kind of exploding in the mid to late 60s. The students and the workers, there's a kind of solidarity that emerges there for a period of time. There's also all kinds of broader contextual stuff in terms of, you know, we're a few years out from the end of the Algerian War, different economic issues that are coming to a head in France and political issues. And it all sort of comes together in the largest population center, Paris. But this is also a moment of European-wide protest that involves students and workers in various ways, worldwide protests. So Paris in 68 is connected to other places in 68. And then there's very specific French things that are going on that bring this about.
The stench of tear gas, fallen trees, and burned out barricades. The aftermath of a night of rioting in Paris, the city they called the capital of peace. After dark, the demonstrators began throwing up walls of bricks, iron grills, overturned cars, anything movable. Using tear gas and concussion grenades, the police charged. It was the beginning of a 5-hour battle on the barricades, the worst street fighting in Paris since the Second World War. The Latin Quarter was laid waste. 460 people arrested, 360 injured.
I have a today lens on Paris and France, and I associate protests with France because somehow I always ended up being there on May 1st. And
oh, yeah.
There was always a protest on May 1st, and there was always violence and, you know, tear gas and that kind of thing. Can you draw a line between 1968 and this kind of the ongoing protests that happen in France?
Oh, absolutely. And you can draw a line in both directions, right? So Paris is considered a center of revolution since at least the French Revolution of 1789. And that atmosphere of urban unrest, people taking to the streets, that idea that French citizens have a right to do that, to express their opposition to the state or to various other things that are happening by heading into the streets in the thousands and the millions, mm-hmm. that is a long-standing tradition. It happens all through the 19th century and into the 20th century. 68, as it's shortened, as it's referred to, 68, May 68, even though it went into to the end of June, is one explosive moment where, you know, millions of people end up on strike in France, workers throughout the country. But that tradition, I mean, when I used to live in France, like every Saturday, you just kind of knew that if you know, if you're in a car or something, that you'd be rerouted because there's a manif over here or whatever. There's some kind of social action over here. It's just sort of understood. And I've always really admired that, that there's this real commitment to expressing your political views and to people really rallying and getting out into the streets. I think we do that here sometimes, mm-hmm. but not with the same kind of regularity and intensity as the French do it.
So earlier we were talking about how the legacy of colonialism and the role that plays in French history and music. There's another song that kind of addresses that theme.
Yes, this is a song. Well, it's a cover of a 1940s song by Charles Trenet, who I mentioned earlier. The song is called Douce France, but it's performed here in the 1980s by a group called Carte de Séjour.
Il revient à ma mémoire des souvenirs fariniers. Il revient à ma mémoire des souvenirs fariniers. Il revient à ma mémoire des souvenirs fariniers. Je revois ma blouse noire lorsque j'étais écolier. Sur le chemin de l'école, je chantais à pleine voix des romances sans paroles, vieilles chansons d'autrefois. Douce France, cher pays de mon enfance, bercé de tant d'insouciance, je t'ai gardé dans mon cœur. Aux maisons sages, où les enfants de mon âge ont partagé mon bonheur. Oui, je t'aime et je te donne ce poème. Oui, je t'aime.
So this sounds nothing like the original song.
It really doesn't.
It's a cover, as you said, of an earlier one. Tell me about the original before we talk about this one.
So the original is one of those classic songs that, you know, is kind of a tribute to France, the nation, how sweet it is, how lovely. And it's like a real positive song and nostalgic. It's sort of a nostalgic song about childhood and about growing up in France. And so an iconic song. And then in the 1980s, it was covered by this group that was formed in 1980 by Rachita, who is Algerian. R.I.P. Rachita died in 2018. And it took on this whole other significance to have this group that combines sounds, North African sounds, including rai, this sort of Algerian music that takes on pop sounds as well and like kind of mixes those, and singing a song that was so much the kind of song that represents old school, what we would say Français de souche, like from the roots, right? This that type of France to be sung by these people from parts of the former colonial empire. Yeah.
And people who've called themselves as a group carte de séjour, which actually means residency permit.
Yes.
So the message here goes beyond this particular song.
Yes, absolutely. For them to sing the song is meaningful, but the song was also released at a moment of, well, I mean, when is there not a moment of intense debate about immigration in France? But this was a particular moment of intense debate about immigration, about nationality, about who is French. And so a group that, you know, called Carte de Séjour, singing a song that's a classic of French national culture that is usually understood to be white and Catholic. This really spoke to, like, brought up the history of the former colonial empire, but also the legacy that is there in terms of immigrants to France, their children who are French citizens, all of those kinds of issues. I mean, the thing with Douce France is it is sort of like a, it is a love song to France, but it's sort of claiming that that love can also come from a different place or come from different people, and that 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 community has a right to Frenchness and France as well. I think when we move into the later 80s, when hip-hop and rap influences kind of come into France, then the assertiveness and the resistance that comes with those musical forms around questions of race and belonging and nationality, that really gets going in a much more intense way into the later 80s and 90s.
And you have an example of that too.
Yes, it's a song from the 1990s by a group called NTM, and the song is called Qu'est-ce qu'on attend?
Voici une réalisation spectaculaire qui prélude à l'extension de la ville conçue dans un esprit futuriste et grandiose, le Val Fouré.
Les années passent, pourtant tout est toujours à sa place. Plus de bitume, donc encore moins d'espace vital. Et nécessaire à l'équilibre de l'homme. Non, personne n'est séquestré, mais c'est tout comme c'est comme de nous dire que la France avance alors qu'elle pense. Par la répression, stoppée net.
Let me go over some of the lyrics in this song. From now on, the street no longer forgives. We have nothing to lose because we never had anything. In your place, I wouldn't sleep peacefully. The bourgeoisie can tremble. The thugs are in the city, not to party. What are we waiting for? To set things on fire.
Uh-huh.
What's behind the anger in this song?
Class inequality, for sure. Racism. The song begins with a promotion for these massive suburban buildings that were built to accommodate large communities, especially of immigrants and of poorer people. They're known as the HLM, and in the suburbs. So I think we have in North America, especially, an idea that the suburbs are a place for white flight, whereas in the French context, the suburbs, they can also be that, but they are often the places where poor communities are kind of pushed outside of cities like Paris that are sort of unaffordable for people. I mean, we know about that here too, I guess.
Well, the name banlieue has come to mean something other than suburb.
Yes. It's come to be associated, like from a somewhat racist perspective, to be associated with crime, poverty, anger, violence, the burning of cars, like these sorts of things.
In the urban trench warfare that rages in Paris suburbs, the night belongs to rioters. Angry young men, mostly of Arab origin, who throw stones and bottles with seeming impunity at retreating police.
Now, of course, as you say, the fate of those areas has long been a subject of discussion, let's say, and immigration has been a subject of discussion in France, but they definitely took on a new meaning as more extremist behavior and acts and attacks came to France. Can you speak to that?
I mean, there's a lot of different storylines there, and one of them is certainly that forms of radical Islam have been able to intrude upon and gain ground in, especially among younger populations who are marginalized in other ways by French society and who don't see other options. So there's the resentment and violence of that is connected to the kind of social and economic inequality and racism that I talked about earlier. But there's also this other storyline about the inroads that radical Islam has made within the French context. And there's a kind of a collapsing of all of those problems and questions into one, so that the banlieue, rap music, all of these other things become associated very intensely with terrorism and the fear of terrorism. And in that atmosphere of fear, it's not that there aren't real issues of concern, but in that atmosphere of fear, there's been this kind of combination, viewing Islam as the source of France's problems, seeing everyone who lives in the banlieue as an immigrant, even though some people are second or third generation. So using that term immigrant to refer to people who are born in France, all of those things coming together.
But those things have really played a role in modern politics and defining, new parties and new attitudes in the political scene.
Yes, yeah. I think the extremes of contemporary French politics have definitely been tied to these perceived social ills, to the perceived threats to the French nation and French identity, to threats that have been understood as threats to French secularism and republican values. And the music kind of expresses some of that as well. Yeah.
You have one last song for us, which is perhaps unlike every other song we've heard today. What is it?
It really is. It's a song that was released in 2001 by Daft Punk, and it's called Digital Love.
This song is probably the least political of all the songs that you've chosen. What's significant about Daft Punk?
To me, so Daft Punk was formed in 1993, this duo, you know, that really came to represent a French version of electronic music, club music, dance music, you know, variously referred to as French touch and other kinds of ways of referring to it as French. They just disbanded a couple of years ago, although who knows, maybe they're coming back. I don't know. And I think this music, the popularity of Daft Punk around the world, that kind of universal sound that is still French, like the music is, when there are lyrics, they're in English.
Yes.
But they are very, to me, they sound incredibly French. And I think the French are still very proud of Daft Punk.
Hmm. I'll tell you, the first few years I listened to them, I had no idea they were French.
I think a lot of people have no idea that, they don't, nothing about them is francophone in an obvious way. I think that there's all sorts of sounds coming out of France now, and that this is, Daft Punk isn't making music right now, but there's still French rap, there's still pop music that's francophone, like Angèle, there's Somai, who's a huge international sensation, also Belgian, also really popular in France. I think there's such a mix of sounds coming out of France now that it includes things that seem to transcend and also music that's still responding to what's happening in France today.
Roxanne, thank you so much for bringing all this great music to us.
Well, thank you, Nala, for having me and for listening to all these great songs with me.
You were listening to French Evolution, the history of France in 9 songs. Roxanne Penchassi is a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. This episode was produced by Matthew Lazen Ryder, with special thanks to John Scaife at the CBC Archives. Ideas is a podcast and a broadcast. If you liked the episode you just heard, check out our vast archive, where you can find more than 300 of our past episodes. Technical production, Danielle Duval. Our web producer is Lisa Ayuso. Senior producer Nikola Luksic. Greg Kelly is the executive producer of Ideas, and I'm Nala Ayed.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.